Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
They call me Q Ward, and that just so happens to be my actual name.
Yes, indeed. Another one for you today. A big one for you. Crazy week. You say that every week, but unfortunately.
We say that every week, unfortunately.
Yeah, a lot to talk about, and the sad reality is that, unfortunately, this is an hour-long show, and so I already know that we won't be able to cover everything that's happened in this past week, but we will cover some important things, some things that are a long time coming, and of course we'll try to discuss some of the police interactions that have taken place on the streets this week. If we have enough time, we're going to talk about what happened in Virginia with, you know, the police pepper spraying the Army lieutenant, pulling him out of his vehicle, and of course we have to talk about what happened in Minnesota with the police officer mistaking her taser for a gun, and how that resulted in another lost life for all of us human beings. And so please stay tuned, because there's those and like 15 more that we've discussed during this week, Q and I, and we just know that it's very sad. You have to understand that when we do this show, we have to watch all of these videos. We have to like live that trauma, and we do it with the intent of sharing it. And again, it's not always possible to share everything, but we'll do our best. But before we get there, we have something that is equally important. And as I stated, long overdue, we have discussed, you know, things that have happened with our Asian American Pacific Islander brothers and sisters, and how the climate in the country has kind of shifted in such a way to where they are under attack more than they have been in recent years. But according to the history of this country, it's nothing new, because they, just like us, are very easy target when things become convenient for the majority. But because of, you know, we had to discuss voter suppression, we had to discuss, you know, all these things that were happening, and, you know, the way the schedule of the show works, we didn't get to have this conversation until now. But again, just as important. And so on today's episode, we have Shella Yu. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. And she is a member of the AAPI Democratic Caucus, as well as an activist and an artist. And I've seen some of your art as well. And so wonderful to have you on the show today to discuss, the goings on with respect to your community. Now, because this is a radio show, not everyone can see what you look like. And so I'd like for you to give them a background of, you know, your ethnicity, and then also, talk about yourself a little bit, you know, your place in the city and how you came to hold these positions and so forth.
Yeah, I come from Chinese parents. I'm Chinese American. I identify as Chinese American.
Very good.
My parents immigrated here from Taiwan with the intention to raise my brother and I here in Arizona to give us better lives. They thought that the education system was better here, so here we are. And how I came to where I'm at right now, that's a long conversation.
Well, some people they have a story that's like propelled them into like becoming an activist or whatever. And so
yeah, okay.
There.
I think if I go back, I was thinking about it on the way here. Actually, I always root for the underdog. Because I get really frustrated when I see any kind of injustice happening. I think fundamentally I have a sense of empathy and clear conscience around humanity and just moral direction. You know, just on the just like flat line, let's be good people to each other no matter what the background is. You know, we all deserve a chance to eat, live good lives. And I was a massage therapist for 10 years and have always had art and music as a part of my life, but didn't really feel like I necessarily had the confidence to go out strongly. And this last year, 2020, crazy year, I had the chance to be at home for 2 months with nothing to do but my art and music. And so I took that time to really explore and to have that space, almost like, remember like back in the day when you were a kid, it was like summertime and time didn't really exist and you're just out there doing your thing. Like
absolutely.
I got reacquainted with that part of me, and having that spaciousness to sit and create and just be with myself and not feel obligated to anything else gave me confidence. And then wrapped up into that, which I think is really key, is the social unrest. Obviously, the Black Lives Matter movement was a really big component of just the whole year, 2020.
Absolutely.
I think was really key. Taking the time to listen to our current civil rights leaders, Ta-Nehisi Coates, I was reading Ibram Kendi, you know, just trying to understand where I fit into this picture. And then wrapped up into that was the pandemic and being then targeted as a scapegoat and recognizing, like, I'm just gonna jump right into it. Are you okay? Okay. What I think is important for Asian Americans, if we are not already feeling this, I think we need to recognize that we now know what it feels like to have targets on our backs in the modern world, and understanding that this is not new for our Black and brown brothers and sisters, and to recognize that we have to do a lot of soul searching to know that our struggles, though may appear different, are actually very similar. And it is racism, it's perceptions of power, it's power over, it's oppression. So that is big component of what I'm trying to reckon with within myself. And so I really want to say thank you for giving me the opportunity to come sit at the table. I've been having these conversations with my Asian American friends about how this is new for us. Asian Americans have been silent, and there's a big history of why that is. We can go into that. I can talk about that. But it has prevented us from feeling safe or comfortable to speak out on matters. And right now is a reckoning, and we have to take the time to speak up. So here I am. Hello.
So and we appreciate it, of course. and you're always welcome. That's what this space is for. I do want to say that, you know, this show is not designed to look in the past. We're not looking backwards in terms of, you know, who did what to who, that sort of a thing. We're really looking forward. Generally speaking, obviously, we have to account for the past and we have to really deal with it. But that's the space that we try to maintain here. So, you know, there's really no worries. We're all about community and moving forward. So again, we appreciate you coming up. This table is your table as much as it is anyone else who is a part of the human race. It is a decidedly Black space, but, you know, my understanding is that all people are born from out of Black people. And so this is a space for all of our children, if you will. Mm-hmm. So, we're going to get there together. I do want to share a quick story. And that's that I met Shella at a Stop Asian Hate rally / candlelight vigil for the victims of the shooting in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And that was heavy. And I think that I don't know why I'm saying this, but I feel like I need to say it. It felt kind of new. That might be a mouthful. It might be very sad, but it's almost like when we hear about Black people losing their lives at the hands of white supremacy, directly, indirectly, whatever the case, the police brutality, injustice, you know, and so forth. It's almost like a normal kind of pain. And because we deal with it so frequently, maybe it's that we know how to cry in a way that is, I don't know, because I don't want to deny anyone's feelings who's lost someone or who has felt their feelings. But what I'm trying to say is that this event, the Stop Asian Hate / Candlelight Vigil, the pain felt different. And I was there, and I mourned with a people that were coming to terms with, you know, as you mentioned, a new reality. And for Black folks, it's not a new reality. It still hurts. And, you know, I understand that all of us human beings, no matter what side you're on, we all love our dearly departed. But to mourn with folks who had not really, it's like kind of like we're just born to cry, you know? And then when you see people who are not, it's like, oh no. And your heart goes out in a different way, I suppose. But it was very meaningful to meet you there, and some of the other folks that you work with. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was a beautiful event. I was glad that I was able to participate and listen to the leadership. I participated just by, you know, holding a candle. I did not speak. It was not my place to do that. I was just there to participate, and it was beautiful. And it was a time for me to learn. And I think that that's something that I learned by watching so many of the other folks that came out in 2020 to the BLM rallies or to the We Rising events or to the other events that took place on the streets, where there were Black spaces and Black leadership shared Black ideas with Black folks and everyone else who came to support. And in this space where I met you, it was just beautiful to see all the members of, well, not all, but the members that put on the event from the API community, you know, take the microphone, speak with conviction and so forth. And so not only was it beautiful, it was, I think it was healthy, and it was, of course, necessary. I want to read something, and please forgive me. I think it's very important. I had we call her our teacher, Dr. Camilla Westenberg. She was on the show when we were first able to broach the subject of, you know, Stop Asian Hate. And she shared a passage with me that she wanted me to read on the radio, and I've been saving it for this episode, and so I want to share it with our listeners. If there are no objections,
please.
So this is from a woman named Isabella Wilkerson. It's from a book called Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents. And it goes as follows. We in the developed world are like homeowners who inherited a house on a piece of land that is beautiful on the outside, but whose soil is unstable, loam and rock, heaving and contracting over generations. Cracks patched, but the deeper ruptures waved away for decades, centuries even. Many people may rightly say, I had nothing to do with how this all started. I have nothing to do with the sins of the past. My ancestors never attacked indigenous people, never owned slaves. And yes, none of us was here when this house was built. Our immediate ancestors may have had nothing to do with it, but here we are, the current occupants of a property with stress cracks and bowed walls and fissures built into the foundation. We are the heirs to whatever is right or wrong with it. We did not erect the uneven pillars or joists, but they are ours to deal with now. And any further deterioration is in fact on our hands. Unaddressed, the ruptures and diagonal cracks will not fix themselves. The toxins will not go away, but rather will spread, leach, and mutate as they already have. When people live in an old house, they come to adjust to the idiosyncrasies and outright dangers skulking in an old structure. They put buckets under a wet ceiling, prop up groaning floors, learn to step over that rotting wood, tread in the staircase. The awkward becomes acceptable, and the unacceptable becomes merely inconvenient. Live with it long enough, and the unthinkable becomes normal. And so, I did want to talk about some of the historic events that have taken place. And I know that we don't have time to go into all of them. And so I implore you, if you're listening to our show today, to check out our social media. It's everything is at Civic Cipher, CIVICCIPHER, but in this moment I'm referring to our Instagram or our Facebook page. And we posted earlier in the week some examples of some historic examples of discrimination against the AAPI community in mass by the government. It's not hidden, it's not written in a funny way, it's not, you know, disguised. You know how they like to disguise racism and legalese and, you know, bills and whatever, legislature. No, it was outright written that way. And you know, I'm not sure how it feels to grow up with that history. I'm not sure if a lot of folks know about it, but we, the Black delegation, have certainly done our best to hold this country accountable for things like that. And far be it from us to forget about those things right now when our brothers and sisters are in a time of need, and we need government action and government protections and so forth. But I did want to ask you, what was it that went through your head when you saw, and I'm sure you did, that video of the man attacking the woman out in front of the hotel? Or what went through your head when you learned that a person went into this massage parlor? And, you know, what is it like to wake up on that morning? Because a lot of folks don't know what that experience is like.
Well, it feels like an attack on your body. As a young Chinese American woman who has dealt with a number of sexualization over the years, and having, this is the thing about the Asian American experience, is that so much is shoved under the table, and so most of the time we don't have spaces to deal with the trauma, deal with the pain. I'm really grateful I've had a group of Asian American, mostly women, that have been able to hold space for each other, because it that particular week, when I found out about the shootings, it was really painful. It was it made me walk differently. It made me carry myself differently. When I've walked into public spaces, it's like suddenly I'm walking around with armor, and like my whole body is tense. And whereas my natural demeanor is smiling, I'm friendly, I like to say hi to everybody. But these experiences are forcing us to really question why. I've had to recognize and take some time with myself and realize, like, part of how I carry myself and why I make a point to speak is because I want people to recognize really quickly, like, hey, I'm from here. I don't have an accent. But the truth is, not everybody can show up that way. Like, my parents, they both have accents. It's harder to hide, you know. And especially right now, we've got masks on, we're walking into spaces. Like, there have been moments when I've left public places, stores, like walking out of Home Depot the other day. I actually ended up calling a friend because I was on the brink of a panic attack. It's like that feeling where I don't know if something's about to happen, and you walk out of a public space and feel like, oh wow, I survived. I survived without any racial slurs, without any dirty looks. And a lot of Asian Americans are feeling that way. We're feeling that way before these shootings because of the former occupant of the White House saying, scapegoating Asians.
Yeah, you don't have to say what he said.
Yeah, we know what he did. Causing that discomfort. And so this is showing the true colors of what that kind of languaging does to this like underbelly of America, right? I've been like sitting a lot with like, oh, we really exist in two Americas.
Actually, that was kind of what I was thinking it might feel like. Now, this is not the same. This is only me trying to empathize, not trying to write the story. But I would imagine it's like one day waking up and feeling like a stranger in your own house. Yes. You know, you mentioned your parents, and I know what it's like to worry about your parents. That feeling sucks because you have to, this is capitalism. We have to get out here and get busy, so you can't, you know, watch folks every day, especially people who are vulnerable, people who don't have the same fight in them. Mm-hmm. And you recognize that they're in a vulnerable stage. And so, I think it really helps to know what that's like, so that we can understand and better empathize. You know, I want to share something briefly. You know, before Q and I started the show, we had a conversation with my older brother, whose mother is Korean. His name is Raka, Irish Science of the Dilated Peoples, for folks who don't know. And he's the one who made sure that we built into the show, which we would have done, of course, but he wanted to make it a point that it was a space where we could also allow other folks to come to the table and share their stories. It was important that we rise in solidarity. Mm-hmm. And you know, his mother is one of those people. You know, she's an Asian woman. I know her. She used to change my diapers when I was little, you know. So she still loves me. She loves my kids, you know, everything. The kindest person, and to know how vulnerable she was and is now, is particularly concerning. But also he made sure to mention some resources that folks can, you know, check out if they want to be more supportive. So I want to read some of the things that he mentioned, and of course I want you to offer some resources for folks who are willing to offer, even just showing up and holding a candle. They want to donate money or anything like that. But before we get there, I checked out some resources on social media, and if you're on Instagram, these will really work for you. One is Asians with Attitudes on Instagram. If you look those guys up, they're right on top of this. They have a lot of things that really shine a light into the AAPI community and experience that you otherwise would not know about. And we follow them from the Civic Cipher page, and we've been able to establish a dialogue and let them know that we're willing to support whenever we can. Another one is at Next Shark, which is another group that does the same thing. And then there's another one, Asians Never Die. I like that word, or I like that name. Mm-hmm. But that's another one, that he mentioned. And then, of course, we went on to have a conversation about the history between Black people and Asian people in this country, and how, you know, in a lot of ways we've been able to support each other, but in a lot of ways there's still a lot of growth that we need in that relationship so that we can really be there for each other in the ways that are really important. So, you know, more to come on that. But mm-hmm. Before we go to break, I want you to mention any resources that you may know that folks can take advantage of.
Yeah, something I think is great is these bystander intervention workshops that have been coming out. I was on the Asian Americans Advancing Justice website. They're out of Chicago, and they do online workshops. And so a lot of them are full right now, but stay on and check them out and make sure that you can see what they're doing. And then also in Arizona, there's AZAANHPI for Equity. And they do a lot of great work to provide resources.
One more time. What was that?
AZAANHPI for Equity.
Okay.
And they've got a lot of great resources.
Awesome. Okay. Well, very good. So a lot to work with there. And if you're just tuning into Civic Cypher, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
They call me Q Ward.
Special guest in the building, Shella Yu, who's a member of the AAPI Democratic Caucus, who is just a wonderful human being, and helping share an experience with all of us that we may not know about, and of course, resources to help support our Asian American and Pacific Islander brothers and sisters. We also need to talk about the goings-on of this week. Q, I want you to do this because this week has been really tough for me. I know it's been super tough for you. But I want to share a story before I pass the mic off. You know, as I mentioned when we started the show, we have to watch all of these videos. It's not like, you know, that if you know, you know that at a point you just don't need to see it. You know the way the story goes. You don't need to see a human being get executed, or you don't need to see someone get hurt. It's not cool to watch it. It's so taxing and draining emotionally on your spirit. And then once everything is drained from your spirit, you find that all that's left in that space is tears. And, you know, you try to be as tough guy as you want to be. You know, I don't really try to be a tough guy, but, you know, I'm old enough to feel what I feel and not making excuses for it. And I really do feel it. But this week, I picked up my son from school. You know, he's in kindergarten. He got out at 10:30 or whatever. And then we went to grandma's house. And I know she's listening. So I love you, Gotti. So we went there and, you know, my son got to hang out with his grandma. And then he went upstairs to play with his cousins. And that was that. And so she and I are downstairs and we're talking. And if you know Gotti, she's a New Yorker. Black. The most amazing person. Just the light in so many people's lives. And I need you to know that because I need you to understand what happened. We got to talking and I says, hey, Gotti, I got to step outside for a second because Q texted me a video that I need to watch because he said he can't watch any more videos. And Gotti asks me, well, what happened? And I says, well, the police pulled over a young man. And the officer says she mistook her taser for a gun. They shot the boy, the young man. He's 20. I'm 38. I was an adult before he was born. So I think I can have that. But you can't call him a boy. That's bad for your health. But they shot him, and then he died in his car. He tried to get away from the police. And we got to talking. And, you know, everybody asks what happened. But Gotti knows better. Because Gotti knows that, you know, it's common for any creature endowed with consciousness to seek their customary freedom. First and foremost. And anybody that challenges that narrative, I immediately don't have any more space for a conversation with you. But if I allowed for you to get that off in my space, the next thing would be, you know, well, why is he running? You know, all these questions, right? Now, I don't know how true any of this stuff is, but I had to do some research, and what I found is that he he was too young to be carrying a gun once upon a time, which is the same crime that the guy in, where was he when he shot those people, the protesters? Rittenhouse, I think is his name.
Kenosha.
Anyway, Kenosha, there you go. Same crime that he had, you know, he was too young to carry a gun. And, you know, I know that immediately folks' minds go to, oh, and then he ran from the police before, perhaps for carrying a gun. And folks' minds go to, okay, well, you know, why was he carrying a gun in the first place? And I think right there the hypocrisy begins, because at that point, what we've done is we've reframed this young man as criminal with criminal intent, which may or may not be the case. But I think to judge that is extremely unfair, because as a citizen of the United States, the only person that should judge him is an actual judge. Certainly shouldn't be judged, tried, and executed on the street. But I think that also that narrative fails to account for so many other things, not the least of which is that this whole country is gun crazy. The guns are the cause and the solution, quote unquote, to all of our problems. Guns and money. And you'll find, if you get old enough, that money won't save you. And you'll find that if somebody pulls a gun out quicker than you, that a gun won't save you. Guns are not for protection. Guns are for murdering. Protection is a bulletproof vest. Think about it. But, you know, and these are just my thoughts. The main thing that I think that folks have failed to come to terms with is the history of why a 20-year-old child on his journey feels so afraid of the world that he needs to carry a gun. And my belief, and what I've seen more often than not, even when I listen to music that glorifies these sorts of things, and when I watch movies, the types of movies that are about, you know, the places where Q and I come from, Compton, Detroit, you know, cities like that, is that the idea there is I'd rather be caught with it than caught without it. And so you come from an environment where having access to a weapon like that may serve as preventative protection, you know, and I'll allow for that. Again, I'm not a gun person at all. Q knows that because we argue about it all the time. But, you know, I've had to allow for that space. I walk my path and everyone else walks theirs. But that environment was not created by black people to be what it is. It's artificially constructed. We know in the history of this country that when black people have gotten together and pulled their resources, our resources, and we've really sought independence, economic and otherwise, from, you know, the larger community, that it's often been snuffed out, literally burned to the ground, time and again. And ghettos are the direct result of redlining, which we talk about on the show from time to time. And if you're not familiar with it, it is the illegal practice now of basically artificially inflating property values and providing loans for white people to move into white neighborhoods, and denying anyone else, not just black people, but anyone else, from doing the same. And what you see during the time where redlining was prevalent, the early 1900s in this country, is a massive shift away of wealth, away from, and there wasn't a lot to begin with, away from black folks to white folks, which a lot of white families still enjoy to this day. And then you have impoverished communities, you have ghettos, and in ghettos and impoverished community where there's lots of scarcity, you get behaviors that are or often borderline criminal. And again, it necessitates some degree of protection from the environment that you're born into. And so this child carrying a gun, whether or not that's even true, from an older traffic stop, you know, that's why he had a warrant. It's from having a gun before and then running from the police before. In no way warrants his execution. In no way, we didn't have a gun at the time. He was trying to run away from the police, understandably so, because the police are very trigger happy in this country. And he lost his life. You know, we've seen that if you stay and cooperate, the police don't treat you good. We've seen that if you run away, the police don't treat you good. There's really a no-win situation. And so I wanted to make sure that I said that, because as I was discussing this with Gotti, she looked at me with this horrified look on her face. And when I saw that look, I knew what was coming next, because I saw the picture of the boy, Dante White, and I knew that he bears a resemblance to her grandchildren, nearly all of them. And I says, whatever you do, please do not look at his picture. And she just started bawling. And when you see an older black woman with the grays in her hair and the skin that has been aged by time, and you see that face, that beautiful face, light up when she sees her posterity run in the house and kiss her and run upstairs to play their games, and she laughs and giggles in the kitchen and has a good time. When you see that turn to fear and pain, and you see the tears squeeze from her face, it's the most heartbreaking thing that you can imagine. And I wept with her in that moment, composed myself. I went outside and I watched the video. I made sure to stay outside long enough for the winds in the house to change. I wanted to share that before I check in with you, Q, because that's how my week went.
Before I get into how my week went, because the last couple weeks have been really rough. I lost my father's first grandchild and my first nephew. First niece or nephew in my father's children's line to COVID. This Thursday will be 2 weeks ago. And he just learned he was going to be a father. Typically that'd be enough. Except because of what we chose to do, because of this space that we chose to occupy, there is a level of trauma that we have to volunteer for. It's the only way we can responsibly do this show. So we see, hear about, and read more of these type of things than most people. I got dressed coming here today, and when Grayson sees me get dressed, he knows that I'm about to leave him. So as soon as he sees me put on a shirt, he starts crying. Like, okay, I know what this means, Dad. I'm three, but you're getting dressed, you're about to leave me. And he cries. And in the moment, it always seems silly. Baby, Daddy has to go to work. I'll be back. Except for a week, I couldn't celebrate my son out loud because my oldest brother is preparing to bury his son. So there was an inherent guilt. Like, I can't be out here joyfully lifting my son up. My brother will see this. And without trying, he's going to think about the fact that in the way that you're not supposed to, he's preparing to bury his first child. And then I just shared a picture with my colleagues here in the studio of Dante Wright and his son. And that guilt kicked in even more. His one-year-old doesn't even get to experience his dad. He won't have any memories of him. So when I'm walking out of the door today and my son starts crying, I can't even in good faith reassure him that I'll be back. Because what we're starting to learn is that there is nothing that we can do to avoid this wrath that's just out here looking for us. dressing properly, pulling up our pants, speaking with a good dialect, using the King's English, staying in between the lines on the highway, driving the speed limit, stopping at the red light, using your blinker, saying no to drugs, not drinking, not driving, complying, yes sir, no sir. It does not matter. It will seek us out. And with everyone sitting at this table today, it will seek us out because of how we look. Because of the way we entered the world, not because of any choices that we made or didn't make. Not because we did or didn't listen to our parents, not because we do or don't obey the laws. Because the person carrying around this hate and resentment has made up their mind that their world is better without us in it. And we just have to hope we're not the one they run into that day. And in this space, even the thing that says to serve and protect is scary. Even more so, because they have a gun for sure. Now, in the open carry state of Arizona, everyone might have one.
They definitely have
one. But the officer that got behind me when I turned off my street and route to the studio right now definitely does. And now I'm driving here terrified. And I've done absolutely nothing.
That happened today?
That happened right now. I didn't get pulled over. I just saw a police car behind me. And there's anxiety and fear and stress. And that's with a cop car behind me. Now imagine that cop isn't in his car anymore. He's standing next to yours. And it's dark.
I don't have to imagine.
And there's no one around.
Totally don't have to imagine that.
And you can do nothing to protect yourself. The safest thing you can do is rid yourself of your self-pride. Rid yourself of your dignity and bow to this person. And then pray that that's enough. Be reverent, comply, be respectful. Yes, sir, no, sir. Do whatever they say. Even if you fully understand that your human and civil rights are being violated, because the object is to not die today. We're not trying to avoid jail. We're not trying to avoid this ticket that in a lot of cases we don't even deserve because we had an air freshener hanging from our rearview mirror. Let's hope that this seasoned professional with a murder tool pointed at you is in a better headspace than you are. As you sit there terrified, you're not comfortable, you're not rational, you're scared. But let's hope the person that does this for a living isn't more afraid than you. Or that they just don't hate you because you're you and feel like killing you today with impunity.
That's the part that hurts. There's no consequence.
And your family and your friends almost know that there's no consequence. In the event that they're charged, the charge will be lesser. In the event that they're convicted, the sentencing will be lighter. And in a lot of cases, neither of those things even happen. You have cities, states, municipalities, district attorneys that find no reason to even bring charges, even when it's recorded on video.
And that's something I want to talk about too. The I think it was in Virginia. The lieutenant is driving. He bought a new vehicle, right? He's driving and it's dark when the police turn on their lights, right? It's on camera. He drives until he pulls into a well-lit gas station. This is what he says. But because the police were behind him for a little bit, they treated it as a hostile traffic stop, I guess, is what they did. And I want to talk more about this. But as far as this goes, the reason that they turned the lights on is because he didn't have a standard license plate, and they said they couldn't see his paper tag from the new vehicle in the back window. But as soon as they got into the to the gas station that was well lit, you could see it in the video. You could see the paper. It's a white square in the window.
But do you know what also happens when you get into a well lit area? You can see that the motorist is black. The crime is the skin. It's not the accent. The crime is your face. You can't take it off. You can't speak well enough to change that we all look how we look. That's the crime. Right? Even if there was no tag, no paper tag, no hard plate, no nothing. Dude is literally riding dirty. Right? He didn't just murder a building full of people with an assault rifle. Because when they do that, and they, meaning white men in the United States, forgive the change in my tone here. When they do that, let's make sure they're okay. As a matter of fact, let's make sure the public knows that they're not. Let's feel sorry for them. Let's empathize, because they must have been through so much.
Bad day.
They had a bad day. Thank you.
Thank you. That right? had to hurt.
They had a bad day. So you talk about the idea of that new pain. And I think what you were describing is a callus. It's happened to us so many times that the wound has scabbed over. It still hurts, but it hurts different. But there is a feeling of wanting to protect our Asian American brothers and sisters for going through something that we've gone through so much that we're like, yo,
let me show you how to do this.
Stand behind me.
Yeah. Let me take this.
And I'm going to look at you and say that. Stand behind me. I got you. We got you. If you can hear us, we got you. If you're watching this on YouTube and you can see us, we got you. Because silence cannot happen. Apathy cannot happen. If one of us is going through this, all of us are going through this, period. Because the fact that I can't confidently tell Grayson Anthony Villaflor Ward that I will be home to him tonight is a problem. Because his father is an upstanding college-educated man with no criminal record, who has never consumed a drink, never tried or sold a drug. I should not have to worry for my life when I see a police officer who lied when he took the oath to serve and protect me.
So, I think that it's really important to share a story. And if you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, once again, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
They call me Q Ward.
And we have special guests with us, Shello Yu, again, a member of the AAPI Democratic Caucus, artist, activist, and all around awesome person. You know, I want to tell a story that, of course, had a different outcome from the one that took place in Virginia, but similar in terms of the experience. And this is from me, another person who's never done a drug, another person who has never drank alcohol. I don't even say bad words. I call them bad words, and I'm 38, you know. So let's
definitely
be real.
Say bad words,
but you know what I'm saying. Like I, you know,
Ramses definitely does not.
Nope, you won't catch me doing that. It's just not in me like that. But anyway, you know, I think I have my head on my shoulders. You know, again, college educated, and you know, all the above. Got a lot to live for. Never been into any nonsense. But even if I was, you know,
and let me say,
everybody has a right to.
Please, before you start your story, even if I was a criminal,
a
bailed out felon with a t-shirt that said gang member on it, I do not deserve to be murdered.
Mm-mm.
In the street.
Mm-mm.
Hard stop.
So
sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. I think that needs to be said. So yeah, a quick story before we get out of here. Once upon a time, I was driving in my brother's car, who he had quote unquote inherited from my sister's boyfriend, now fiance, right? My sister's boyfriend had moved out of town and left the car, and my little brother started driving it, and so it became his car. I have a small interest in a used car dealership, and so sometimes I switch cars and sell cars, and just people want to buy the car I'm driving, and so that's what happened. So I'm driving this, hear me on this, it's a 2006. And when this happened, it might have been 2017, 18, somewhere in there. 2006 Dodge Magnum, black tint, black interior with 22-inch rims on it. It is the most gangbangerous, drug-dealingest car. You look like you're just serving the block in this car. I cannot stand driving that car because I know how it looks. You know, I'm from California, right? I love lowriders. I think they're the coolest things in the world. I have a lowrider bike downstairs at my house. And, you know, I recognize it to a lot of police. It looks like criminal. You know, it's not cultural, it's criminal. You know, but of course, over here, it's cultural. Anyway, I'm driving the car. And of course, it's not a terrible looking car. It just looks like, you know, I'm moving that weight, as it were. So I had just driven it to, I think, somewhere in Chandler. I want to say Wild Horse Pass. And I picked up $10,000 cash. This really happened.
Oh, wow.
No.
And this is getting good.
Yeah, no. Man. So, again, fortunately, nothing happened. So I don't want to, like, you know, scare anyone. But, yeah, so I got $10,000. And I was wearing some, they're like boots with zippers, right?
I've seen those.
Yeah, I got like kind of a cool style, I think. So immediately I take the $10,000 because it's a brick. You know, when you get that money from the bank, it has the band around it and it says how much it is. So I put it in my boot because where else am I going to put it? It's going to fall out of my pocket. And I know my boots have zippers. So boom. And then it just looks terrible to someone who's looking for something to, you know, suspicious, right? But I had to pick up this money because I was completing a transaction and the person that I was meeting pays in cash. So, you know, there's no problem there. And usually having large sums of money is not the weirdest thing in the world when you work in the industry in which, you know, have interests. So I'm driving on the freeway in a car that's not mine, in a car that's not my brother's. And what happens is I'm right by the airport driving, and the police get behind me and they turn the lights on, right? So immediately I'm like, uh-oh, because, you know, my sister's boyfriend is Jamaican, and Jamaican people, at least the ones that I know, they partake in some things which are now perfectly legal, you know. But he hasn't driven this car for years, so. But, you know, your mind goes to all the places because immediately you're like, okay, what is going to happen to me?
Not even what did I do, but what is going to, what could happen to me?
Exactly. And so the mistake that I made was, you know, being on the freeway. The freeway splits where I live by the airport. There's a split in the freeway, and I'm supposed to be on the split on the right side. But on the left side, it goes to a whole different freeway, a whole different direction. And I'm not, I don't go that way. So I'm lost if I go over there. But the police are behind me trying to pull me over. So just like the story in Virginia, I slow down. I turn on my hazards or blinker or something like that, so the police know I'm not trying to run away.
Not evading.
Evading, correct. But I didn't pull right over, because I would have been lost and it would have been dangerous if you would have seen it. So I'm waiting for the kind of the fork to arrive at the fork, and then I can pull over in that area and they can get out and do their business. But then they start like honking the horn and flashing the lights at me. And so now I'm like really afraid because of that same thing. Like if they're upset, it's going to be very bad for me. So I pull all the way over, right? And they, of course, because I didn't pull over immediately, treated it like it was a hostile traffic stop. So it's like guns blazing, this whole thing. So they get out, they got guns on me, and I know the drill, because I don't know if I mentioned it on the show before, but I'm from Compton. So even before I was getting pulled out of the car, I've seen other people get pulled out of the car, and I know the easiest way to survive is you roll the window down and you put both of your hands outside of the window facing away from the officer, just like that. You know, so they can see your hands. Yeah, leave them there until they approach the vehicle, and then you have your conversation. So that's what happened. They walked up. By the time they got to me, I could see that they put their guns away, and the guy started talking to me. Of course, he asked me to step out of the vehicle, and I'm not the one to play that game, because I want to live and I know how this goes. So I'm like, okay, stepped out of the vehicle. Of course, I called my sister and let her know what was going on. This was a few years before Facebook Live and all that sort of stuff. So that was what I did. Get out of the car. And of course, they asked me all the standard questions. Have you been drinking? Any drugs? These sorts of things. And I tell them the answer. No, sir. I've never drank alcohol in my life. No, sir. I've never done any drug in my life. I don't even like taking medicine, just in case I have to talk to you one day. I didn't say that last part because I didn't want to upset them. But you know what I'm saying? Like, that's really the reason. So... he later tells me, he's like, yo, that sounds exactly like something a meth head would say. So that's why we pressed you on this. And I was like, oh, well, now I know not to say that I've never drank alcohol in my life and never done a drug in my life. But, you know, he could tell that I was not inebriated because, again, I've never been inebriated. And then they started asking me where I was going and where I was coming from, which for some reason is important, because that's what happened on the videos we saw this week. Some of the videos. I told him I'm leaving the casino. I had to, you know, conduct a business transaction. I'm praying that he doesn't check my shoe because then it's all over. And they find that 10 G's in my boot, which they didn't find. But the whole time I'm sweating because of that. I'm super nervous. And the thing that bailed me out, and this has been a get out of jail free card for me a couple of times over the years, is that I work on radio. And when they called for backup, one of his partners recognized me as being a DJ. And then ultimately the first guy ended up apologizing and everything went well. But anyway, I'm saying that to say that I relate to the trauma, to the stress, and to everything that goes along with these stories. But unfortunately, we're out of time for this week. And so please do us a favor, visit the website civiccipher.com, download this and any previous episodes. I want to thank our guest, Shella Yu, for coming to hang out with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And be sure to check us out next week, both myself, Ramses Jha, and Q Ward. And until then, y'all, peace.
Peace.